About 2 United States worth of people are living in extreme poverty around the world still today. And so a lot of people understand we try to focus on how to improve those people's lives. But the overall picture is one of a lot of positivity.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Percent of people were living in extreme poverty in 1981, but by 2019, that number had fallen to 9%. So how did this happen? Tom Vogel of UC San Diego is one of the authors of a paper entitled simply, How Poverty Fell. So when I caught up with him, I asked him, what's the answer to this question? So Tom, hello.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me on.
Now, Tom, many people just assume that poverty hasn't fallen at all, and certainly not to the extent of the statistics that you report. If we were to think about it in numbers instead of percentages, how many people today are not living in poverty because of this reduction in an extreme policy we've seen since the 1980s?
So that's actually a bit of a tricky question to answer. In the 80s, about 2 billion people were poor by the standards we use, and now it's more like 700 million. And so the number of poor people has declined by a little over a billion, which is already a lot, right? But the world's population has been growing too. And so if we multiply the poverty rates of the 80s by today's population, then about 2.5 billion people, more people would be poor. So I think that's the number that best answers your question.
Even on the lower bound of your reply there, it's an amazing story. Why don't we hear it told more often?
Well, I guess we tend to focus on the work that's left to be done. There's still a lot of suffering out there. You know, about 2 United States worth of people are living in extreme poverty around the world still today. And so a lot of people understand we try to focus on how to improve those people's lives. But the overall picture is one of a lot of positivity. You might actually be familiar with the work of the late Hans Rosling, a Swedish doctor and public speaker who tried to get these ideas out to people around the world. So he worked really hard and charismatically, I'll say, to remind audiences of how much better off people across the world are today than 50 years ago, as measured by prosperity and survival. So he's unfortunately no longer with us, but the website Our World in Data continues his work.
Now, with this paper, what did you set out to do?
So I think the best answer is that when Paul and I were in grad school almost 20 years ago, Abhijit Banerjee and Esther Duflo put out a wonderful little paper called The Economic Lives of the Poor. And so, you know, Abhijit and Esther would go on to win the Nobel Prize for their work on randomized controlled trials. But this paper was 100% descriptive, essentially just a bunch of summary statistics from a lot of household surveys all around the developing world. It just described the lives of poor people, you know, how they spent their money, how they allocated their time, from whom they borrowed money, and so on. And so since then, anytime a researcher wants a broad fact about the lives of poor people, you know, like how much did they spend on weddings, what interest rates did they pay on short-term loans, you know, the list goes on, that researcher would typically start with the Banerjee and Duflo paper. And the paper went on to be one of the top 10 most cited papers for both researchers, which is no small feat because, you know, each of the papers in the top 10, competes with my entire publication record and citations. But it really speaks to the fact that researchers really need these facts to help motivate, to help situate, to help interpret their results from studies that are more focused on particular policies or programs. And so Paul, Vinny, and I want to do something comparable over time. So, you know, instead of asking how the lives of poor people look from a static lens, to ask a more dynamic counterpart to the question, which is what happened over the lives of the poor as they escaped poverty. So that led us to two big questions that motivated, all of the analyses in the paper. The first one was how much poverty decline happened over people's lives as opposed to between their lives and their children's lives. And the second was, to the extent that poverty decline happened over people's lives, what changes in economic activity accompanied their escapes from poverty? And so we set out to assemble comparable answers to those questions from as many countries as possible.
Yes, as many countries as possible. Which countries did you focus on and how did you pick them?
Yeah, so, you know, when I say that, it's a little disappointing because we end up with 5 countries, which, you know, I have some papers that analyze data from, you know, 200 countries. When we got into it, we realized that the data we needed were not available from that many countries. That the amount of work required to paint this picture that we wanted for each country was a lot more than if we had just focused on a single slice of the data that we wanted to do for many, many countries, right? We wanted to do many slices of the data for as many countries as possible. We ended up with 5 countries. So there were China, India, Indonesia, Mexico, and South Africa. And the reason for that was primarily for data availability. So for each country, we needed 2 types of data, both spanning many years. For the first question on inter versus intra-generational change, we wanted to use repeated cross-section data, which give these repeated snapshots of the population. And for the second question about the factors that are associated with household escapes from poverty, we needed panel data in which the same households are followed over time. So we found only 5 countries that had both types of data spanning enough years for us. It so happened that 3 of those countries, that's China, India, and Indonesia, accounted for more than 2/3 of global poverty decline.
Not to criticize your work in going through the effort to find this data in the first place, but data on the poorest people in society is often extremely hard to find. It's not as well recorded. How reliable do you think your sample is?
Most of the surveys we use are either run by national statistical offices or by experienced researchers who put a lot of thought and expertise into sample design. And so most of them are really as high quality survey data as you can come by. So, you know, you can't do better in terms of representativeness, for example, than the 2 data sets we use from Indonesia. At the same time, in China, we had to relax our quality standards a bit because we felt it was really important to include China in a study about global poverty decline. So, you know, this is getting into the weeds a bit, but the cross-sectional survey from China is national in scope, but has no details anywhere about how the sample was drawn. And the panel survey is drawn from a large number of provinces in which much of the Chinese population lives, but not in a way that makes it fully representative of those populations, right? I guess the other issue that one would bring up about data quality is attrition in these panel surveys that follow the same households over many years. So, you know, those households, if some of those households eventually drop out of the sample. For 3 of the panel data sets we use for Indonesia, Mexico, and South Africa, the researchers worked quite hard to track migrants as they moved around the country. As they moved abroad, attrition is minimal in those data sets. Actually, all 3 of those data sets were run by, or all 3 of those surveys, I should say, were run by academic economists. The Chinese and Indian panel data sets don't work as hard to track migrants, and so there's a bit more attrition there.
This data spans quite a long time period. How do you draw a poverty line that you're thinking people are either below or above over that time?
Yeah, so here, I guess one thing to say is that our results don't depend very strongly on which poverty line we draw. That's something we know personally, but we haven't. There are a few places it appears in the paper, but we haven't put all of the sensitivity checks we want to add to the paper yet in. So we use the conventional extreme poverty line, which is about $2 per day in 2017 US dollars. That's just an inflation adjusted version of the original dollar a day poverty line that some researchers from the World Bank said in the 90s. Dollar a day was just a rough aggregation of national poverty lines set by governments in the poorest countries in the world at the time. Right? And so there's no sort of deep theory underlying these poverty lines. Well, maybe the poorest countries in the world in the 90s had a deep theory underlying their poverty lines. But Martin Ravalian and his colleagues at the World Bank just basically looked around. They noted first, of course, that poverty lines in wealthy countries are higher than poverty lines in poor countries. And so, you know, if you use the US poverty line or the UK poverty line to define poverty, you would wind up with a lot more poor people around the world, right? And so they said, let's take the poverty lines of the poorest countries. Surely everyone can agree that people below that line are poor. We still have 700 million of those people in the world today.
Let's take a break. We'll be back in a moment.
My name is Oliver Hanney. I'm the managing editor here at VoxDev, and I'm here to give our VoxDevlets a short plug. We now have 14 available on our website and the same amount currently underway. VoxDevlets from VoxDev are easy to read, policy-oriented literature reviews that will help you to stay informed. In each VoxDevlet, experts in their field distill the evidence on important questions in development economics.
What's interesting is that it is actually trying to do different things.
Every time we answer a question, it raises one or two more.
From agriculture to trade, from bureaucracy to mobile money, VoxDevlets are open access, accessibly written, policy-focused and regularly updated. Find them at voxdev.org/voxdevlet.
This is a really interesting set of questions. It opens up a whole can of worms.
And stay tuned for our upcoming release on electricity infrastructure and an update to our VoxDevlet on the informal sector.
Tom, you compare between cohort and within cohort changes to the numbers in poverty. What's the difference between this? Why does it matter that we distinguish between them?
Right. So as I said before, one of our big picture goals was to think about inter versus intra-generational change. So does poverty decline in the population because people get less poor over their lives, or is it because their children grow up to be less poor than they are? So given the data types available, the best we can do on this question for the countries in question is to ask how much poverty decline accrued over the lives of people born in the same year. So we call those birth cohorts. And how much accrued to the replacement of older, poorer cohorts with younger, less poor cohorts, right? And so cohorts are our approximation here for generations, although, of course, they're not exactly the same thing. So it turns out for all five countries that basically all cohorts experience similar poverty rates at a point in time, and that those cohort-specific poverty rates just declined in lockstep as time progressed.
And what do we understand from this about the relative contributions of these two effects?
So those patterns imply that almost all poverty decline accrued within cohorts as opposed to between them. So, you know, things basically got better over time in a gradual way for everyone, right? Now, that's still consistent with large gaps between generations over their lifetimes. So if you consider cohorts born 25 years apart, the younger cohort is going to experience lower poverty rate at every single age than its older counterpart did 25 years earlier, right? And so lifetime, the younger generation is less poor than the older generation. But at the same moment in time, those cohorts are equally poor. The economic interpretation of these patterns is complicated, and we don't push a particular narrative, but we think it's useful to check these patterns, and we think that they imply that we should look carefully at the within cohort changes.
One thing I noticed about your methodology, when you are looking at the within cohort changes, you base that on income and not consumption, which is often used. Why did you make that choice?
So I guess the simple answer is practical. All of the panel surveys that we use for these within cohort analyses have income, but not all of them have consumption. But we think that income is appealing on conceptual grounds too. You know, in the within cohort analysis, we're particularly interested in how we're particularly interested in the economic sources of exits from poverty. And while income can be assigned to specific sources, consumption can't. So that said, for the surveys that have consumption, we can do some of our analyses on consumption instead of income, and we find very similar results.
So in looking at what's going on here, in the countries that you are measuring, how fast are households exiting poverty? When they exit poverty, do they manage to exit poverty for good?
Yeah, there's a lot of poverty escape in our data, but there's also a lot of slippage into poverty. And so, for example, in Indonesia, which is perhaps our longest panel, half of the households that were initially poor at the start of the panel escaped poverty over the subsequent two decades. But a quarter of the initially non-poor fall into poverty, right? And so, you know, overall, and this is true across all of the countries, the rate of escaping poverty has exceeded the rate of falling into poverty. But there's just a lot of churn.
I see, because we hear a lot about the poverty trap. This is implying that maybe the narrative is slightly different.
I guess the idea of a poverty trap tends to make us think that, you know, some households would be persistently in poverty, and maybe that poverty decline would involve permanently moving them out of that status, right? But instead, what we see is just a broad improvement in economic circumstances with a lot of individual volatility. So we think that sounds a lot more like climbing a slippery slope than vaulting out of a trap. I guess I'll still say that, you know, there's a longstanding development economics literature looking for specific formal conditions necessary for a poverty trap, right, in theory. And our results don't speak directly to that literature, right? It's, for example, not clear that the poverty trap would line up exactly with that dollar a day poverty line that the World Bank set in the 90s, right? Because that dollar a day poverty line wasn't chosen with any particular model of poverty traps in mind.
So when we're looking at what's going on here, when households are climbing out of poverty, Tom, is it that traditional structural change story that they sort of find something else to do? They move out of agriculture, maybe move to a city, work in industry. Is that a story in the data?
So we asked whether poverty exit and entry coincided with changes in place, as you say, or sector or occupation or women's work. The results are weaker than one might have expected if one had the view that you just put forward. So we find that most households exiting poverty did so without changing their status along one of these margins. And also that households entering poverty often change their activities in ways similar to households exiting. And so we think that these results are consistent with a world in which no one path out of poverty predominates. And so there are numerous and intricate paths out of poverty. One thing I want to say, though, is that that doesn't mean that migration to cities or movement out of agriculture or changes in occupation or so on didn't cause poverty decline. So, for example, it could be that rural-urban migration reduces rural poverty by boosting rural wages because it makes labor scarcer in rural areas. Okay. But for sure, most households who exited poverty did so without moving to the city.
As you say, there are multiple paths out of poverty, and one policy that has been extensively employed, increasingly so, has been the use of transfers. In your data, how significant has the use of transfers been in lifting people out of poverty?
So we find that transfers accounted for very little poverty decline. There's some variation across countries, but mostly people tend to receive transfers when they fall into poverty and to stop receiving transfers when they rise out of it. So those patterns are consistent with transfers acting as social insurance. So they are called, you know, the social safety net. You know, our analysis is descriptive and we can't really speak to the causal effects of transfer income on escaping poverty. But our views on this is actually quite positive. You know, these transfer programs are supposed to help people when they're down on hard times. And they seem to be getting to people exactly when they have, you know, a dip into poverty.
More women are working outside the home. Has this been significant?
Yeah, so here, I think our results are somewhat encouraging. So in all of the countries we study, when a woman starts working, her household becomes more likely to exit poverty than households where a woman stops working. And in fact, in Mexico and South Africa, when a woman stops working, it's associated with a big increase in poverty. That's not true for the others. So there's scope then for thinking that rising women's labor force participation can help poverty decline. But here's where the numbers of those households making transitions become important, because households with a woman entering the labor force are just not that numerous. Right. They're way, way, way outnumbered by households with women who either stayed out of the labor force throughout the entire sample period or who worked throughout the sample period. And those households also experience poverty decline, just at a somewhat lower rate. And actually in China, this is an interesting case. The largest share of households in the population, or in the sample, I should say, had a woman leave the labor force, and those households also experienced substantial poverty decline. And so we think that's consistent with a world in which rising income allows women to stop working. So that's sort of a reverse causality story. And that highlights, of course, the limits of a descriptive analysis like ours.
So I'm going to finish off with an easy question for you, Tom. When you put this all together, what does this tell us about which policies have worked?
Yeah, that's, I guess, the million-dollar question. Let me first say that a lot of development economists have been working really hard to estimate which policies worked and which didn't. And, you know, it takes a full paper for any one policy to give anything close to a convincing answer. And we aren't trying to take the place of the rest of the development economics, right? So we see our paper as having a role for maybe shaping our priors, maybe guiding us in where to look. For example, in most countries, poverty exit is more widespread in households that stay in agriculture than those that switch from agriculture to another sector. And so, that challenges the view that exiting agriculture is crucial for a particular household to get out of poverty. But as we discussed earlier regarding the urban-rural margin, there's still scope for agricultural exit to raise agricultural wages through an equilibrium channel, as I described. A well-designed study could test for that sort of a channel. Right? And so overall, I'd say our goal isn't to make prescriptive statements on based on our descriptive analysis. We all take causal inference very seriously. And we don't see our analyses shedding light on causal questions. We think instead that, we're laying out some facts, and facts are important, both for shaping causal inquiries and for understanding the results. And our goal is to lay those facts out about how poverty decline happened in several important parts of the world in a way that's comparable across places.
Well, it's a fascinating, it's incredibly useful paper, Tom. Thank you very much for talking about it.
Thanks, Tim.
The paper is called How Poverty Fell, and the authors are Vincent Armentano, Paul Niehaus, and Tom Vogel. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where you will find articles about the topics we feature. And remember, if you like what you see and hear, leave us a review and tell someone else about us. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber and our editor is Andrei Zalgarian. Thanks to Oliver Hani and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.